Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This week, we have been examining the health and environmental impacts of the toxic chemicals in our everyday lives. On Monday, we talked about the lack of regulatory policies and testing chemicals adequately. Tuesday, we delved into the $71 billion cosmetic industry. And yesterday, we turned our attention to toxic chemicals lurking in our homes. You can find all of our shows at kalw.org or yourcallradio.org. Today, we are ending our series by looking at our food system. We are exposed to a cocktail of chemicals, additives, and pesticides in the food we eat. More than 6,000 chemicals are used to harvest, process, and package our food. For example, the Pesticide Action Network found 54 different pesticides on conventional spinach, including 5 that are linked to cancer, and 47 pesticides on conventional apples. And then there's the packaging. 6 nonprofits, including the Breast Cancer Fund and Environmental Defense, recently tested and identified the interior linings of 192 food cans containing things like vegetables and fruits. It found 2 out of 3 cans contained linings from bisphenol A, commonly known as BPA. That's an endocrine disrupting chemical that impacts our hormonal systems and might contribute to a host of harmful health effects, including breast and prostate cancer, infertility, asthma, and attention deficit disorder. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about what we need to know about our modern food production and packaging methods and our exposure to toxic chemicals. How does the FDA determine what is safe for human consumption? Today, we are joined by Kristen Schaefer. She's Program and Policy Director with the Pesticide Action Network, an organization that works to create a just, thriving food system. And Kristen joins us from her office in San Francisco. Hi, Kristen. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose.
Good morning. We're also joined by Elizabeth Grossman, a senior reporter for Civil Eats. That's a daily news source focusing on the American food system. Elizabeth is the author of many books, including Chasing Molecule and High Tech Trash. And Elizabeth joins us from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Elizabeth. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have both of you. And Kristen, I want to start off with you because the Pesticide Action Network has an amazing website called What's on My Food. And you can click on foods from almonds to apples to asparagus and find out what's on the food. And I was shocked to learn that on conventional non-organic spinach, there are 54 different pesticides. How is that even possible?
Yeah, thank you for the introduction. And it is amazing. The whatsonmyfood.org website is actually, it's not our data, it's government data. So this is data that is pulled together on an annual basis by USDA and FDA, and they look at what residues are found in commonly on common produce and so on. And we've just pulled it together so it's a searchable database, again, so you can look by food and find out what pesticides have been found and also what health effects are linked to those chemicals. I should clarify that that number 54 doesn't mean that on a single sample of spinach necessarily there were 54 pesticides. That means that in all the sampling that they've done, that there are 54 pesticides that have been found in total, so that's the risk that you have that any number of those 54 might be in a single sample of spinach. The way that we encourage folks to use the pesticide is first to make smart choices for your family. And you mentioned spinach, and that was growing up my daughter's favorite food. And so knowing that there, you know, is the risk of all of these pesticide residues that might be found in spinach, that's something that I might prioritize to invest in organic spinach when I go to the grocery store. Then the second way is to use it as a conversation starter tool. It's really interesting to be able to look through and pull up, you know, foods that are that you eat and show your neighbors and talk to your friends and say, hey, did you know that, you know, 54 different chemicals might be found in spinach that you're buying, and sort of start those conversations about the importance of healthy food. And then third, what we hope is that folks will then, as they kind of become more educated and understand the sort of scope of the issues around pesticides, that they'll get more involved in and get involved in policy campaigns and look to make changes at the local, state, or federal level to move us toward a safer system of food and farming.
And so for the 54 pesticides on spinach, 7 known or probable carcinogens, 21 hormone disruptors, 7 developmental or reproductive toxins. Again, this is at different times, so it's not like there are 54 pesticides at one time on spinach. But as someone who maybe doesn't study this, it's hard to really wrap your head around all of this information.
It is a lot to take in. And the thing that also I think is really interesting to think about is how what we know, what science is telling us about the special vulnerability of children to these chemicals, especially at very low levels. And I should say that most of these chemicals are found at very low levels that are below what are considered safety levels, the EPA tolerances. The limitation there is that EPA sets those tolerance levels one chemical at a time. And clearly, if there are multiple chemicals in one serving of spinach, then you know, that's not necessarily a protective level. And the other thing to highlight again is that children are especially vulnerable to these chemicals for a lot of different reasons. The scientists basically say the first 7 years of life are really the most vulnerable window for children, where their bodies are growing really quickly, their organs are developing, all of their bodily systems are developing quickly, so chemicals can kind of derail those processes of development. In addition, they take in more of everything, pound for pound. Kids are breathing in more, drinking more, and eating more than adults do for their weight. And then thirdly, they haven't yet developed their defense systems. There are certain enzymes that help us as adults kind of try to clear out some of those toxins, and children don't have those developed in the first 7 years of life. So that's an especially vulnerable window, as well as prenatal exposure is really critical as well.
We're going to talk more about children because you were the lead author of an amazing report called A Generation in Jeopardy about, it looked at 200 studies exploring how pesticides are linked to a range of childhood health harms. And we'll talk about that later in the show. But before we do that, Elizabeth, I wanted to ask you, over the last few days, we've been talking about the regulatory process and, you know, why so few chemicals are tested. And what does it look like for food? Because you often hear that the process is much better when it comes to testing food for safety. How are pesticides and other chemicals in food regulated?
Well, as you probably gathered from your previous conversations, none of this is simple, and there's quite a complicated layer of way these chemicals are regulated. And one way to think about it is that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, sets the regulations for how pesticides can be used, and that includes setting what the EPA considers are safe limits or levels that are safe to be exposed to. But then it's the Food and Drug Administration that does the monitoring, along with USDA, the Department of Agriculture, for some foods, for the presence of pesticides. That said, there are far more pesticides that are actually used than any of these federal agencies actually monitor for. So we don't actually know the levels or about the presence of every possible pesticide that could leave a residue in food. When it comes to food packaging materials, or what the FDA calls food contact materials, chemicals that can come into contact with food but aren't directly mixed into the food when it's being processed and prepared, there's a whole other set of regulations for how those limits are monitored and how those safety limits are set, and the same is also true for food additives. So it's very, very complicated, and a couple of little facts that are pretty striking is, in addition to all of those thousands of substances you mentioned at the beginning, there are now more than 6,000 different synthetic chemicals and other substances that governments in the U.S. and Europe have approved for use in packaging. But in the past couple of years, there have been a number of studies done that showed we don't actually have complete information about how those chemicals might affect human health. In fact, about half of them we are missing that information on. And another study done a couple years ago found that about 175 chemicals that are used in food packaging are, in fact, chemicals that are known to have adverse health effects, some of the kinds of things that you described earlier on, the hormone effects, effects on learning and behavior, and similar types of health effects. So a very complicated system and one that has left a huge amount of information missing. And the other complicated piece of that is that to a very large extent, when it comes to the food packaging materials and the food additives, the government agencies rely on information about these chemicals that is supplied to them by the companies that use and make them. So that raises a lot of questions about who's providing the information. It may be perfectly good information, but it's just not independent information.
Right, and we will be talking more about packaging later in the show, specifically the lining in cans. So cans that hold vegetables, fruits, soups, gravy, that kind of thing. So to try to bring it down to the ground, what we've been doing this week is asking all of the guests, what chemicals or pesticides concern you the most? And Kristen, the Pesticide Action Network has a great article about the six companies that control the pesticide and agriculture markets. This is Monsanto, Dow, BASF, Bayer, Syngenta, and DuPont. So if you had to pick just a few, what pesticides really concern you the most, and how widespread are they?
Yeah, we call that the Big Six, and those six companies really control the vast majority of the market in pesticides and increasingly in seeds as well. So it's an interesting question of which pesticides. I would go with a couple of families of pesticides. One is the organophosphates, which are insecticides, which are very widely used and have been shown to cause neurodevelopmental problems. So exposure, especially prenatal exposure and early childhood exposure, there's very strong science that links this family of chemicals to neurodevelopmental harms, including reduced IQ levels, increased risk of autism, ADHD, and so on. The second batch I would point to are herbicides, which are especially widely used in the Midwest, and there's been a really sharp increase in the use of herbicides that are sold together with genetically engineered seeds, so herbicide-tolerant seeds, the Roundup Ready, for example, strain, as well as new strains that are now coming out that package other herbicides together with Monsanto's Roundup. And we're concerned about these herbicides partly because they're so widespread, and new evidence is showing links to increased risk of cancer from exposure to the herbicides, especially, again, during prenatal exposure. And we have to be concerned. It's a public health issue when these chemicals are used so widely and new health harms are emerging day by day.
And Elizabeth, what about you? What concerns you the most?
Well, Kristen picked out all of the pesticides that I probably would have focused on. And when it comes to the other types of chemicals that can get into food, either intentionally as additives or as packaging contaminants or simply as contaminants in food because they're out there as contaminants in the environment, I would pick, I would include BPA and its replacement chemicals because of its hormonal effects. There's another category of chemicals with a funny sounding name called phthalates, which are used primarily to soften PVC plastic, the vinyl, that kind of flexible plastic wouldn't bend without these phthalates, and they're used in a lot of different types of equipment and packaging that's involved in food. I would also pick the chemicals that go into making nonstick surfaces that have fluorine in them, and they're also used in waterproofing compounds and also in greaseproof food papers. They're those things that go by the shorthand of PFOA and PFOS that we've just been hearing a lot about in some articles, because they've turned up in water systems in upstate New York and in Vermont and in the Midwest. I would also pick artificial food colorings, which lots of companies are now phasing out because of their association with adverse behavioral effects in children. And when it comes to things that aren't intentionally added for food but get into food because of environmental pollution, I would pick heavy metals, things like lead and cadmium and mercury, that all are known to have serious adverse effects on the brain, and that's particularly important for children. Those kind of things get into food through water, and they've also been found to get into food through contaminated soil and dust. And the last thing on my list would probably, even though they are no longer used intentionally, they're still out there, and they have a serious range of health effects, and that would be PCBs. And they are still very much out there, and sometimes they can actually turn up in food packaging unintentionally because the dyes and some of the colors used to print food packaging create these in the process. And we don't know if they're, you know, I don't know how much people are actually eating, but I would definitely include them in environmental contamination.
And this is in food packaging?
Yeah, they're okay. In food packaging, and they also get into water, which means they can get into fish, and anything that's in water can create a problem when you're preparing food, you're cooking, you're washing things. So I think we have to think about drinking water in the context of the food system as well.
That is Elizabeth Grossman. She's a senior reporter with Civil Eats, a daily news source focusing on the American food system. Kristen Schaefer is program and policy director with the Pesticide Action Network, an organization that works to create a just, thriving food system. And be sure to check out their incredible website called What's On My Food. You can click on anything from blueberries to carrots, eggplant, you name it, garbanzo beans, canned. This is interesting. One pesticide was found on that. To find out what's in your food and what questions do you have about what's in your food, what's on your food, any pesticides you have questions about, if you are a farmer or work on a farm, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this issue. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have a question from Rob, who says, how much have things changed since the book Diet for a Poisoned Planet by David Steinman was published back in 1992? Can this book still be recommended as a reference? Kristen, do you want to take that one?
Sure. I think we have seen a tremendous amount of progress. I think it's interesting the level of awareness from consumers and awareness of what it means to make smart food choices, both in terms of protecting families, but also the impact that has in the field, I think has grown tremendously. And so you see the organic, for example, sector of the food industry has been the fastest growing sector for the last 10 years straight within the food sector more broadly. It's still a tiny percentage, but I think we have seen tremendous progress. I think what I would say is that from our perspective, it's been frustrating how slow EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, is in responding to new scientific evidence of harm among these pesticides that are used widely. And so in that way, I think that we still have a long way to go, but we have seen a tremendous growth in consumer awareness and concern and growth in the organic food sector.
And Elizabeth, what would you add to that?
I think we have made a lot of progress in terms of awareness, but the other thing that has happened is we're constantly adding new chemicals to the inventory of what's being used, and we're really far behind in understanding exactly where those chemicals are being used and how much of them are getting out into the environment. And the other thing that I think has happened is that there has been a huge increase when it comes to herbicides, in the use of herbicides, and without an accompanying increase in understanding where those chemicals are. And so, yeah, I think we have made quite a lot of progress, and there's now a lot of science to show that if you eat food grown without chemicals, you end up with less of them in your body. How this translates to health is the next piece of research, but at the same time, we're still playing a huge game of catch-up in understanding how these chemicals can affect human health and how much people are being exposed to.
Well, since you brought up organic food, Kristen, what does the data tell us about chemicals on organic food?
Yeah, you can see on what's on my food, it shows, you know, sampling data of organic, and it's in some cases actually zero. In some cases, there are slight tiny residues, but the difference is very clear. And as Elizabeth noted, there have been many studies that compared basically pesticide levels in children's bodies when they're eating a conventional diet versus an organic diet, and very clearly the metabolites, the breakdown products of those chemicals, drop significantly even within a week or two of shifting away from conventionally grown foods. So there is really clear data that shifting to organic does absolutely reduces exposure levels. And I would note actually that one of the things that we found in pulling together the report that you mentioned earlier, A Generation in Jeopardy, is that the American Society of Pediatrics flagged that pesticide residues on food are the primary source of exposure among children across the country. It's an issue that at that level, American Association of Pediatricians is calling for awareness and flagging this as a problem that parents and pediatricians should be aware of.
We were talking about this earlier in the week when we talked about body products. A new study by researchers at UC Berkeley found that young women and girls who take a break from makeup, shampoos, and lotions that have a lot of chemicals lead to a very significant drop in levels of hormone-disrupting chemicals in the body. So what we've been hearing from our guests this week is that the chemicals enter your bloodstream very quickly, but they leave the bloodstream just as quickly. Does the same process does that also apply to food? Do you know, Kristen? What does the data tell us?
Absolutely. It depends on the type of chemical. For most chemicals, the OPs that I mentioned, organophosphates, that are especially harmful to neurodevelopmental, can derail neurodevelopmental development. Those can pass through the body really quite quickly, and those are the chemicals that were focused on in the study that I mentioned. There are some types of chemicals that last longer in the body. Organochlorines, which are in the same family as DDT, which has been banned for many years but still shows up in the environment just as PCBs that Elizabeth mentioned earlier, those can last in the body for years and years. So it depends a little bit on what type of chemical you're talking about.
And the other thing that I would add to that the report that Pesticide Action Network did reflects is that the timing of exposure to these types of chemicals is really, really important. And if somebody is pregnant and they're exposed, and that means that their developing baby is also being exposed, those kind of really early life windows of exposure, or very early infancy and childhood exposures, even if they happen for a short period of time, they can have long-lasting effects. And that's particularly true of chemicals that can affect how hormones work and also can affect how the effects on neurological development, on brain development, learning behavior. A chemical exposure that happens at a really crucial stage of development might not have to be for time at all, but it could have lifelong effects. And there have just been a number of studies that are looking at the healthcare costs of these lifelong exposures and things, again, that happen early in life, not necessarily for a long time, can stay with the person throughout their life.
That is Elizabeth Grossman. She's senior reporter with Civil Eats, a daily news source focusing on our food system. And Kristen Schaefer is program and policy director with the Pesticide Action Network. Today on Your Call, we are talking about pesticides and additives in our food supply. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, a show that's much better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, the toll-free number. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11... it's World Have Your Say, the BBC's global conversation on issues of the day. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will be discussing coverage of the Panama Papers, the largest journalistic leak in history. Over the past year, more than 370 journalists from 100 media outlets in 80 countries poured over 11 million files, revealing how global political and powerful elites use offshore tax havens to hide their wealth and cover up their shady dealings. We will speak with a few of the journalists who worked on this massive investigation. Coming up on Monday, Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, will join us to talk about her new book, 20 Years Covering the Movements. And I'll be in conversation with Amy Goodman and her brother David Goodman on Monday night at the Norse Theater at 7:30. You can find information at cityarts.net. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are continuing our series on toxic chemicals. On Monday, we talked about the regulatory policies. Tuesday, we looked at the cosmetics industry. Yesterday, we talked about toxics lurking in our homes. Today, we are talking about our food system with Kristen Schaefer, Program and Policy Director with the Pesticide Action Network, and Elizabeth Grossman, Senior Reporter with Civil Eats. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Since we started talking about organic food, we had a caller who couldn't stand the line, and I'm sure a lot of people have the same opinion. Our caller said, "I cannot afford to buy organic produce. I do what I can, but this feels like toxic overload. There's really nothing I can do." Any advice here? I'm thinking about the Environmental Working Group's Dirty Dozen list, and it has a list of fruits and vegetables. And they look at non-organic fruits and vegetables that have the least amount of pesticides. Kristen, what advice would you give to people who cannot afford organic fruits and vegetables?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the EWG has a very useful tool. I think the again, pointing folks to the whatsonmyfood.org website where, you know, if you know, as I mentioned, my daughter loves spinach. So, as you know, that's something that, because there are 54 potential pesticide residues on spinach, I would choose to invest in organic spinach. So I think there, whatsonmyfood.org can also be a useful tool for shoppers. I think it is honestly shameful that that has to be a choice. I think that we should all have access to affordable and healthy food that doesn't have residues that are going to be harming our children and our family. And so that's honestly why we do the work we do, is to create, help to build the market for safer and healthier food and put policies in place that are going to support the farmers who are doing the right thing. And there are a lot of farmers that, you know, the farmers aren't the bad guys in this story at all. And a lot of farmers are doing really innovative work to build healthy soil and reduce their reliance on these chemicals. without much support at all from government programs and investment. And so that's something we're trying to shift, is to really reward those farmers who are doing innovative work to get off that pesticide treadmill and reduce the level of pesticides in our food and in rural communities where, you know, children are also affected there, as well as rural families and farm workers.
And Elizabeth, would you have any advice for people who can't afford organic?
My advice would be very much along the lines of what Kristen suggested, and this would apply to products used in your home other than food as well, whether it's personal care products or anything else that you buy to put in your home. Pick the thing that is going to give you the most bang for your buck, so to speak, and especially if you have children. If your kids are drinking lots and lots of milk, seek out the organic milk and spend the money there rather than worrying about a food that you don't eat very often. So make those choices, particularly for young children, for people who are pregnant. Do the things that are going to have make the choices that are going to have the biggest effect. And you really wish it wasn't more expensive, and it looks as if prices are gradually coming down for some organic products, but that hasn't quite happened yet. But again, choosing the products that your family or your children or even you eat the most of would be the way to make those choices.
One more tip. We did a show about food waste a few months ago, and there's a great company called Imperfect Produce. And they found that 1 in 5 fruits and veggies grown do not fit grocery stores' strict cosmetic standards. And so they're selling these imperfect, nothing's wrong with them, they're just not perfect. And they're now delivering organic imperfect produce at a heavy discount. And that's another tip here, and maybe another solution. It's imperfectproduce.com. They deliver in the East Bay, and they just started delivering in San Francisco. So I hope that can help. Thank you for calling in. And I'd like to now welcome our next guest to the show. Dr. Jillian Miller is a staff scientist with the Ecology Center, and they do really great work on this issue, and they have been looking at packaging, specifically canned food. Hi, Jillian. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So we've been talking about chemicals in food, and we wanted you to talk about the new study that came out that took a look at the cans that are used to sell the food. So these are cans containing veggies, fruits, soups, broth, beans. And your lab looked at 192 food cans. What did you find?
Right. We were one of several NGOs on this study, and we, since we have a lab, then we were capable of looking at food can linings. We did the testing part of the study. Like you said, there was a wide range of food types, and we found a range of lining types. So just to back up in case people aren't clear on this, all metal cans have some kind of coating inside. You can also call it a lining. And it's essentially a plastic. They're polymeric linings. We also call them resins. It can be confusing because they have several names. These are there for a very good reason. They protect the food from the metal can, from any dents or dings that might allow bacterial contamination. So it's really important to have that in there. That's what makes them so shelf-stable. But to answer your question, we wanted to determine what the lining types were. We knew we were going to find some that were BPA-based epoxy. That's the most common, and that's the one that people have been concerned about for many years because of the leaching of BPA. But we got very limited information from companies about what else they were using, and so we essentially reverse-engineered the cans. We found acrylics were fairly common, various acrylic resins. There's a resin called oleo resin that is made partially with plant oils. We found polyesters, and the fifth major category was PVC, or polyvinyl chloride, mixed with some other polymers. Those were in addition to the BPA-based epoxy. About two-thirds of all the cans we tested were lined with BPA-based epoxy, so that became the headline in a lot of the coverage of this because people are familiar with BPA and concerned about it. It's a very common environmental contaminant. And canned food can be a significant source if canned foods are a regular part of your diet.
And so what do we know about whether these chemicals leach into the food. So if you're buying a can of soup, are these chemicals then in the soup, or can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, we didn't test leaching or migration of BPA or any other chemicals in our study, but we relied on a pretty large body of research that's published about the migration of BPA, well, particularly BPA, from canned food linings into food. There are quite a few studies there with different food types, different brands. Most of the studies don't actually name brands. So we relied on that body of research to demonstrate that absolutely BPA is in your food if your cans are lined with BPA-based epoxy. The amount that's actually in the food varies a lot. That varies a lot, possibly related to food type, but also related to how the cans are processed. There's some indication that a lot of the leaching may occur during processing, especially when the cans are heated, because that drives up reaction rates and migration rates.
And so it's really important not to microwave canned food.
Definitely shouldn't do that, or heat them on the stove or over a campfire or whatever you might be inclined to do. Yeah, I would definitely recommend not heating anything in a can ever. Take it out of the can. So, yes, there's BPA. Of course, if you go with what the FDA says currently or what the can manufacturers say, they are using what we think is an outdated standard for what is an acceptable daily intake of BPA. There's a lot of indication from scientists and others that the tolerable daily intake should be drastically reduced from what it is right now. So the amounts are, you know, objectively small, but eating a lot of canned foods is definitely going to add to your overall body burden of BPA and your overall body burden of endocrine-disrupting chemicals. And some of these studies look at the levels in urine as well. And another thing I heard some of the other panelists talk about, you know, eliminating certain foods from your diet, or I guess on a previous show, eliminating certain cosmetics from use causes chemicals in a person's body to drop sometimes fairly quickly, you know, within days of eliminating those. And that is the same for BPA from canned foods. There have been a couple of studies. One was done by the Silent Spring Institute, where people were compared on a diet that included a bunch of canned foods, and then they eliminated the canned foods, and the BPA metabolites in their urine dropped significantly fairly quickly.
And just quickly, I've been noticing a lot of water bottles. The packaging says BPA-free, and now I am noticing on cans, I see that BPA-free label. Can we believe that?
Yes. Our study corroborated what the companies are telling us, the ones that say we're not using BPA epoxy in this. We found a different type of lining. So, yeah, we found that what they said was corroborated. If you see BPA-free or non-BPA written on a can label, it means that one of the other linings is being used. So that could be an acrylic, a polyester, oleoresin, or PVC. None of the brands that we know of are actually labeling what they're using other than BPA epoxy. They're just saying it's one of the others,
of the other linings. And they're not required to release that information.
No, definitely not. And we are urging companies directly to adopt policies of much greater transparency to label what's in the can, so at least people can try to make choices. You know, they might read our report and come away saying, okay, we don't really know a lot about these other linings, but there's some indication that oleoresin is one of the safer ones, so I'm going to look for cans with oleoresin. That's an example. It would be easier for consumers. We think it's a right-to-know issue that should be labeled.
Dr. Jillian Miller is a staff scientist at the Ecology Center. Elizabeth Grossman is a senior reporter for Civil Eats. And Kristen Schaefer is policy director at Pesticide Action Network. And we have lots of questions from listeners. Let's go to William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. I tend to get into, you'll excuse the pun, the weeds of things sometimes. And with respect to pesticides, that's the pun. At any rate, as the guest pointed out, the tolerance levels in food for pesticides are established by the Environmental Protection Agency. But testing the produce to see whether the levels that are in them are tolerable, well, is not done by the Environmental Protection Agency. It's done by the Food and Drug Administration. Here comes the weeds. In a General Accounting Office report, 15-38, which was done for the appropriate congressional committee about whether testing was adequate, the following statement appears. The FDA does not disclose in its annual monitoring reports that it does not test for several commonly used pesticides, including glyphosate, that's Roundup, for which the Environmental Protection Agency has established tolerance levels. So the EPA says the maximum level would be safe, and then the Food and Drug Administration just doesn't test for that. And again, that's GAO report, GAO-15-38, and I would appreciate the comments of the guest who discussed the problems with multiple agencies involved.
All right. Thank you for that question, William. Elizabeth, do you want to take that?
I will do my best. As I mentioned, the FDA and also the Department of Agriculture, that also has its own more limited pesticide residue testing program, neither of them test for all chemicals. And the chemical that I'm getting a lot of background noise.
We're having a hard time hearing you. Can you maybe go get closer to the phone?
No, it's not. I think it's coming in from somewhere else.
Okay, well, you're better now. We can hear you better.
Okay, yeah, the noise disappeared. Sorry about that. It sounded like a traffic noise. Anyway, the pesticide that the guest was asking about, glyphosate, is the most commonly used herbicide in the country, and for reasons that are not actually fully explained, the FDA has not ever tested for this regularly in food, nor has the USDA. The FDA says it is now going to begin testing. Don't know when that's going to start. But the same thing is true of quite a number of other chemicals that come into contact with food. There aren't regular testing programs for these, for all of them. So we have these huge data gaps. It's going to take quite a lot of investigating to find out exactly why these things are overlooked, but the testing does not adequately reflect what may actually be in food.
How much does this have to do with the fact that over the last 4 years, the chemical industry, the Koch Network, DuPont, Dow, have spent $245 million to lobby politicians in Washington?
Oh, it goes way... It goes well beyond that, because when it comes to, if we're just going to talk about glyphosate, that's been in use since 1974. So the history goes back well beyond the past 4 years. The political lobbying obviously does have a big influence, but how pesticide safety levels are set, chemical safety levels are set, the science that the various agencies use to set safety limits, that goes well beyond the political lobbying. It's subject to a lot of chemical industry influence that's well behind the scenes of those political campaigns. But it's a big problem.
Well, thank you for calling in, William. Martin in San Jose couldn't stay on the line, but he wanted to know, what about the watering down of organic standards? What does organic mean anymore? Kristen, do you want to take that? Let's talk specifically about organic food and the organic label on food.
Yeah, so there's a National Organic Standards Board, which meets regularly, has a number of stakeholders that review proposals for, you know, how to hold the integrity of the organic label. And it actually has been quite effective. And I think it's interesting that there's been a bit of a public conversation about, oh, can we trust organic? And it's actually a very strong label. There was a battle that we were involved with back in the day, when the first the establishment of a national organic label was under debate. It kind of grew out of a label that was here in California, and the recognition was, hey, we need a standard organic label. And there was a really hard-fought battle to make that as strong as possible. And, you know, more public comment than USDA had ever received in the past was mobilized during that process. And we landed with a really strong label, and I think there is really good integrity there. I would just say it's interesting, in addition to Elizabeth mentioned, you know, the influence of the pesticide and chemical corporations behind the scene on policy, we're also seeing, especially in the last 5 years or so, an incredible investment in public relations by corporations such as Monsanto to kind of try to shape the public narrative about organic and undermine, you know, the credibility of it and question the health harms of pesticides and so on. They have, you know, they've set up websites, and there's an incredible amount of money that's gone into really trying to create doubt where there really isn't doubt about these health effects of pesticides and what needs to be done to move forward. So in addition to that policy, you know, influence and the money that's spent there on lobbying, there's also, you know, a real push in the public sphere to influence the conversation and undermine the credibility of organic and create these questions.
We have an email from a listener who says, is it true that if you wash all of your vegetables with 2% of salt water, it'll remove most of the pesticide residue that normally appears on the surface of the vegetables? Almost 75 to 80% of pesticide residues are removed by cold water washing. Do we know if this is true?
So I can comment on that. It certainly doesn't hurt to wash your fruits and vegetables. The reality is that many pesticides in use today are what are called systemic pesticides. There's several families of pesticides that are actually applied to the plant and the roots and drawn up through the plant and are actually then throughout the fruit. So those pesticides, such as neonicotinoids and so on, cannot be washed off. So it certainly doesn't hurt, but you're not going to solve the problem with washing.
We have an email from Pam about wine. Can you talk about the presence of pesticides, herbicides, and insecticides in wine? We have seen studies in France document the alarming presence of residues in wine. Last month, Moms Across America did a very narrow test of 10 wines, non-organic, and found that they contained 30 times more glyphosate than organic wine. Elizabeth, have you looked at this?
I haven't looked at the wine study, but I know there's been some recent studying in Europe looking at, again, it was glyphosate levels in food made with grain, including beer, and I don't have those numbers at my fingertips, but the study, I believe it was done in Germany, found glyphosate residues widespread in beer, and in the UK, I think they were also found in bread. So it wouldn't be surprising that pesticide residues would be in wine, which is a concentrated grape product that involves using both the outside and the inside of the fruit. So it just would seem logical that pesticides could be present.
Well, thank you for that email, Pam. That's a really important one. Jillian, I wanted to also talk with you. We have just a couple minutes left. We've been doing this series all week, and it feels like the onus is really on the citizen to have a little mini EPA and FDA in their home, which is impossible. I mean, I don't think it's fair to require people to spend all this time online to do their own research, and then when they do the right thing, they find that the labeling is misleading. So, I mean, Absolutely. At the end of the day, isn't this about expecting more from the government to regulate these chemicals?
Yes, and when we do these studies, such as this CAN report, we have targets. It can be either government policy or it can be corporate policy. And in this one, we're targeting retailers and food manufacturers specifically. So we've had conversations with many food companies about transparent labeling, and even more so about subjecting all proposed or in-use can linings and other food packaging to toxicology screens that include endocrine disruption, such as green screen. That's one screening that's created by the group Clean Production Action, or a similar screening. So, yes, for various reasons, we didn't target federal policy this time, but that's for a future project. We've had success in other market sectors targeting companies and having them change their internal policies. Absolutely, you're right.
And Kristen, what would you add? The Pesticide Action Network says we need to stop the revolving door between the industry and the government agencies that are supposed to regulate them, restore competition and fair pricing. What else would you add to that?
Yeah, in terms of, I completely agree that it can be a little overwhelming, and it really shouldn't be on the consumers to have to figure out what food is safe to eat and what is not. So I would say that consumers actually have an incredible amount of power in the dollars that we spend every day. We make food choices. So I think being aware and when we can, choosing to support food and farming that is not reliant on chemicals. And then I think it's really critical for folks to, when they can, get involved in policy discussions around these issues, either in their local communities or state policy. There's a lot of exciting work going on at the state level, and learning how you can plug in and support those efforts that really get resources to farmers who are doing the right thing and protect communities and children from pesticides in rural areas. Lots of good work going on that folks can jump in and help support.
And Elizabeth, final thoughts on this? We have about 30 seconds.
Well, I am not an advocate, but I would agree with the other guests that consumers actually have a huge amount of power, and all sorts of organizations, from environmental advocates to business groups surveying consumers, have found that transparency, the safety of food, the health value of food is now a top priority. And if you just look at what has happened as a result of public concern over chemicals in food and labeling recently, a large number of the very biggest food producers have announced, for example, that they're removing artificial food colorings or they're going to be adding labels to their products. So consumers do have a large amount of power, even if you're not a high-dollar consumer.
Elizabeth Grossman is senior writer with Civil Eats. Kristen Schaefer is policy director for Pesticide Action Network. And Dr. Jillian Miller is a staff scientist at the Ecology Center. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for joining us. You can find our entire series on toxic chemicals at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the Panama Papers, the largest journalistic leak in history. Over the past year, more than 370 journalists from 100 media outlets in 80 countries poured over 11 million files, revealing how global political and powerful elites use offshore tax havens to hide their wealth and cover up their shady dealings. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.